Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Long before Bach, Beethoven, and Beyoncé, humans were making remarkable music all over the world. It told stories, gave advice, captured cosmic visions, communicated what perhaps simple words cannot. My guests today, two top ethnomusicologists, have traveled the world to bring back the rich traditional music of pygmies in Central Africa and gamelan and shadow play in Bali. This hour, On Point, will explore the deep architecture and meaning of some remarkable traditional music, and we'll learn something about the work of the ethnomusicologist. You can join the conversation. What do you hear in the voices and musical patterns of Central Africa, of Bali? Is there a worldview here beyond our own? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Simha Arom, French-Israeli ethnomusicologist and director emeritus of research at France's National Center for Scientific Research. He's best known for his prize-winning series of musical recordings of the Akka Pygmies in Central Africa. He's written a book on African polyphony and polyrhythm, a real giant in the field of ethnomusicology. Simha Arom, it is wonderful to have you with us. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And with us in the studio, Michael Tenzer, ethnomusicologist and professor at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, Canada. His specialty is Bali and Balinese music. He's written the big book on gamelan gong kebyar and has helped plant Balinese gamelan ensembles all over North America. He's a composer, great scholar, and an old friend. Michael, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you both with us. And I want to ask right off the bat, Simha, we heard just behind the introduction there some music from your realm that you may have recorded yourself, for all I know, in Central Africa.
Yes.
What was that delightful kind of mix of percussion and horns? What was that?
It's an orchestra of 18 horns.
18.
And the special thing is that each instrument emits only one single note. And what the music that arises from this is a very complex polyphony, which comes from the overlapping and the imbricment of all those different instruments.
Each instrument only one note, so it's all about the moment when each individual musician makes his or her contribution.
Exactly. Everyone has to be very, very precise.
Is it all men, I wonder, in Central Africa, in this 18-horn band? Or is it men and women?
No, only men. That's initiation music that the boys learn when they go in the initiation camp to learn how to be adults.
How to be, in their case, a man. We'll hear some beautiful women by music by women from this region as well that you've recorded. Mm-hmm. I want to get a little Balinese music in here right at the same time, because part of the pleasure of having you two with us is that we have the kind of interplay or tension between these two great traditions. Michael, we're going to listen to Ginada Basur here.
Exactly.
Tell us about it.
Ginada Basur is a poetic song. It's actually traditional poetry that is given a melody and it is sung almost not like a lullaby, but kind of a didactic or a teaching song to children. And the text, would you like me to read the text?
Sure. And who would sing this? A mother and a father?
Mother. And you'll hear on the recording there's a mother that sings the song in a very flowery way, and then the father translates or elaborates in a different kind of musical idiom.
Mm-hmm.
And this teaches, it teaches the children to be humble and to value knowledge and learning and to never think too highly of themselves.
Give us the lyrics before we hear it.
Don't judge yourself able. Let others name you. Our work is to sweep. Each day the dead leaves fall. Remove them and the dust remains. And in this way, there will always be more to learn.
And you say this is a song that all children in Bali would
virtually
know.
All.
This is in the Kidung, called a poetic singing. Let's listen. Ginada Basur.
Ngadani
saroy do dane ni sarang sami ngento jeneng do ngangkanang dewek aturangi do dane to ngadani anake buku idewo duning
gagi.
And on it goes. This is not Gamelan. This is almost like a lullaby. Paint a picture for us, Michael. Where might this be sung to a child?
At home, at night, when playing with the children in the family compound, perhaps in an informal teaching session where some of the grown-ups in the family compound would gather the children together and want to teach them about their traditional poetry and literature.
Simha Arom, in your work in Central Africa with the Akka Pygmies there, is the traditional music a teaching tool? How much of it is about teaching or versus, I don't know, celebration, or is teaching a big part of it?
Teaching is not the main part of it. The main part is music belongs to every collective action people are doing. Mm-hmm. So it's a very organic thing, and you need it every day. There is not one day in a pygmy encampment without people doing music.
Let's listen to a little more from your realm. Here's a pair. Here's one where a singer is playing a whistle with a single note. Yeah. Let's listen a bit. You can explain to us. From the Benzele Pygmies in Central Africa, Hindehu. What's going on there, Simha? What's being communicated?
A man who is whistling one single note, mm-hmm. and all the other notes he is singing.
Yes, between.
Alternately, mm-hmm. yeah. Regularly alternating one sound, which is whistle, and another, which is sung. That makes a song.
And it gets a little more complex. Here brings in also a clap to keep the beat. Let's listen. Pygmy music for a winter morning, and it's wonderful. What's the message here? Is it just joy? Is it just passing time? Or is there something more? How would you describe it?
There's always something more. There's always something functional. Mm-hmm. This kind of music is played and sung. Sometimes there's two whistles, mm-hmm. two people mm-hmm. doing the same, mm-hmm. and also a choir when the people coming back from the hunt, when they have game, and on the way back to the encampment, they announce for the people, for the elders and the people who are sick in the encampment, well, we come back, we have game.
Hey, get on over here. Come on over. We've got, we've been on the hunt and we've had success. Let's get a caller in right here from Fort Myers, Florida. Keith, you're on the air with Simha Arom and Michael Tenzer.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
All right. I'm a DJ, and first, let me just say that I was just taken back by that previous melody. It was breathtaking.
Isn't that great? Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, I'm a DJ, and I'm taking it from kind of the modern aspect of seeing how sounds layer together and such. Electronic music nowadays actually has kind of a tantric aspect because of something we call binaural beats. I wanted to know what our experts think about binaural beats and how they were developed and take play and the melodies and the drum beats of
binaural beats. Now, I'm not enough of a musicologist to know what that. What do you mean by that, Keith?
Well, it's kind of I may be using methodology a little bit differently, but it's kind of how there's a drum beat in a lot of kind of primal music where it's, you know, like the four beats of boom, 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 boom. And there were a lot of tribal music that could ensue kind of a feeling of excitement or put the listener into a trance.
Do you feel that or find that in some of the music you're spinning these days, DJ Keith?
Yes, actually, that's actually kind of where the term trance music came from, because trance and they call it Goa trance and such like that, where it has these very, very, very tribal, primal feel, primal feel to it.
I love it. We've got the DJ right on the air. Let me throw it to Michael Tanzer, Keith. Stand by there in Florida. Michael, what do you say?
The clap that you heard in the last song was actually probably not there in the original performance, but Simcha asked the musician, because when Simcha heard the original one that you played, he was unable to figure out for himself how to feel the music because of the complexity that it has.
So he was instructing the visitor with that clap.
He went to the musician and he said, can you please do it again and clap your hands so I can understand how you were organizing the music in your mind?
Yes. I came back 26 years later to the same place only for that, to know how it is organized in time, how the people who do this music conceive of it.
And did that clap give you the secret code?
That is a clap. And by the way, it's not binary, it's ternary.
Ternary. DJ Keith, meditate on that for a second. Do you hear in trance music today some connection here, Michael?
Well, I think what the caller was actually talking about was the idea that trance music and some kinds of modern electronic music combine different rhythms in a way that creates patterns that, and when they repeat, it gets people into a certain frame of mind. And you do have that in African music in some ways.
We're talking today with Michael Tanzer and Simcha Aroham, great ethnomusicologist, bringing us very traditional music from Central Africa and Bali. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. We've got with a little gamelan from Bali. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep role and architecture of traditional pre-modern music of the world from Bali to Africa. Behind us right now, Mbola from Central Africa, from the Akka Pygmies, collected there by one of my guests today, the great ethnomusicologist Simcha Aroham. Normally, you'll find him in Paris. Today, he's with us here in the studio. Also joining us today, Michael Tanzer. He's a professor of music at the University of British Columbia, quite the ethnomusicologist himself, specialist in the music of Bali, and we will hear more of that in this hour. You can join us. What do you hear in traditional old ethnic world music that you may not hear in our top 40, our pop songs, or in the Western classical tradition, maybe? What strikes you, calls to you, in the music of Central Africa, of Bali? And can you have a different cultural role, a different point of departure? Do you hear a different point of departure, maybe to life in this music, or something that you already feel or know? You can join us at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Simcha Aroham, tell us about this Mbola. What's going on? These are children singing in Central Africa, pygmy children.
Those are pygmy children, but the song is for adult people. Mm-hmm. And the song, when there is any disorder in the encampment, and people don't know what is the reason of the disorder, so you have to make a ceremony, a ritual, to that everything comes back into order.
To balance the community somehow.
Exactly. To the balance the community, exactly. And here, I record this piece in 71, 1971, the first time I came to this Akka Pygmies, which I didn't leave for more than 30 years.
Yes.
I came always back to the same encampment because there were such wonderful musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And what interested me here is that children, very young children, are able to sing this complex music in counterpoint when they are 6, 7, 8 years old. That's the reason I recorded this song.
How do they learn it? Do they just by standing up with their mates and listening and then singing out?
Yeah. Because you have, this is polyphonic music, like the Bach choir or chorales. But it goes faster. Mm-hmm. When they sing, the women are standing on one side or sitting on one side, and the men on the other, and the young boys with a man, the young girl was a woman. And that's the way they learn. There is no conservatoire, huh? There is nothing. Just to listen and to integrate.
And so there it begins, their education, and it's fascinating to think of this as a kind of calming music for the whole community. Here's a duet, the same song, but as a duet for two girls. Really remarkable, beautiful piece of music, again, from the Aka Pygmy, Central Africa. Delicacy of this is just breathtaking.
Yeah,
breathtaking. What are they also? They're singing this just what, to practice, or singing it for you with your earphones and microphone?
Yes, in this case they sing it for me, but they sing it for their own pleasure. It was one of the two girls was singing it in her hut. You know, they live in small huts. And she was singing alone, and I was recording, and I was very excited because it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And the other girl who was living in the same hut just came in, and I showed her to wait a moment, and then said, well, could you sing it, both of you? Mm-hmm. And then I get it in counterpoint, and that was the thing.
Let me ask you, your life has been spent, moved from Germany to Israel to France, now many years in France.
Yeah.
In any of those countries, you could have two young girls, you know, absent-mindedly singing some song together. But not from this tradition. Now, is there something different going on when two Central African pygmy girls sing this from two girls, you know, singing while they played with dolls or something in Israel or France or Germany? Is it different or not?
There are many differences because the music belongs to the culture. You cannot live in this culture without singing. There is no, I cannot make any comparisons. It is so different because music is an organic part of your life, which it is not in the USA, not in France, and not in Israel. So,
but Michael Tenzer, I wonder. I mean, we're in American culture, for example, we're saturated in music. Maybe we make it ourselves. Maybe we don't. It comes out of the elevator. It comes out of the car. It comes out of the iPod. It's everywhere. So
everybody sings.
Everybody sings in response. Maybe copies, or maybe hums their own, you know, made up tune.
It's true. Everybody sings. Music is part. There's all sorts of music going on under the radar all over the world. We're not just buying and selling, MP3 files and so forth.
But even when we are, is it fundamentally different from listening to Mom and Dad sing it across the village?
Yes.
Green.
Well, I don't know. Somebody else can decide whether it's fundamentally different or not. But the point is that music for us is not required for our daily activities. It's a natural human impulse. Mm-hmm. And lots of our children may sing, but then they might stop singing when they get to a certain age, and then they start listening instead.
Just plug in the earbuds.
Right. Then they cease to be active because it's a very natural human, it's almost, I'm tempted to say, a biological function of being human to make music.
But in this Mbola piece, Simha Arom describes the children calming the village. Couldn't you say, well, that's the same thing as music piped into a mall?
Yes, but that's mediated. That is removed from that's being made by somebody else for you instead of you making it yourself. That's the crucial difference.
Let's jump into some Balinese music here. We've got a lagong, and we've got three pieces of it. It kind of grows in complexity. Introduce this, and then we'll listen to the first cut of it, Michael.
Well, this is a kind of a recording that will enable people to hear the layers of sound that make up a full performance of sophisticated Balinese music, I guess you could say. And so you'll hear three little snips, and in the first one you'll just hear one layer, which is basic melodic, you could say the skeleton. It seems it's very regular and not very interesting, frankly, on its own.
And this is gamelan?
This is gamelan music.
And please describe a gamelan for people who haven't seen one.
Absolutely. Yeah. A gamelan is you could say it's an orchestra, but all the instruments are made of are percussion instruments, and they're mostly made of bronze. Mm-hmm. Bronze-keyed instruments, kind of like xylophones, mm-hmm. With a very resonant and beautiful bell-like sound. Plus, there are some drums that are played with the hands, and I think in this recording, in the final one, you'll hear a flute.
Everybody's sitting on the floor. How many people in a typical...
By the time we get to the third phase of this, it'll be 25 people.
In beautifully carved bases for these bronze kind of xylophones, but many different things. So let's listen to the first simple skeleton of this piece. All right, there's the simple bass, and on that it begins to build. What comes in now?
Okay, now they will take that very simple melody and make it a little bit more flowery and add some drumming.
Okay, here we are with the version two, or the legong. It mounts. And then?
Now we hear some very elaborate, kind of like in the very first piece you played, where all the parts were playing only a couple of notes, but they fit together to make a richer pattern, a kind of interlocking pattern, and that's all the other instruments in the orchestra.
We're talking very rich indeed. Okay, full bore here. Balinese gamelan music. Michael Tenzer, I remember when we were practically babies and you were introducing this to us way back in the dawn of time, hearing this for the first time. It's not my music at all, but it's absolutely entrancing. Something is speaking to me right across that huge cultural gap of the Pacific and more. Mm. It grabs everyone.
Yeah, it does. It does have a very compelling impact on a lot of people. It's a little bit like Alice falling down the hole and coming out in another world, and you see a whole world that's there, but you don't understand how it makes sense.
So we just heard a glimpse of it. What is going through the mind of those musicians, which it may be an invisible movie to me as they're playing that?
What's going through their mind?
Is it Hindu images? Is it Balinese vistas of rice paddy and volcano?
They have learned their music in a very different way from a Western orchestra. Now, here's a kind of orchestra that's halfway across the world. It's 25 people playing together. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the parallel mirror image of the Western orchestra. But these people are sitting and playing without any music in front of them because they have memorized everything and they have practiced it together over and over. So it is a kind of a symbol for their community, interaction with one another, their ability to work closely together and to produce something that is beautiful, which, just as in Africa, serves a specific function in their community.
Of binding and weaving together the individuals.
Also,
does everybody
ritual
play, or most people, or not?
Not everybody, but the point is that the music is designed to fulfill, to weave the community together, and also has specific religious and ritual functions that it has to play. And otherwise, the encampment cannot be purified, or the village temple cannot be purified.
Or calmed or brought together. I love this weaving back and forth. If we may, let's go back to Africa. This is called a song for thinking. Let's listen. Just fabulous. From Gabaya, Africa, a song for thinking. Now, Simha Aroma, have you given it this name, a song for thinking, or is this simply what it is? I certainly hear that one could use this for thinking.
No, this song belongs to an ethnic group called Baya, and song for thinking is a literal introduction of the term, of the appellation of this kind of song in the Baya language. And it's, let's say, a song for meditation. And it's a repertoire of very long, slow-going songs which can be sung by one man alone or by two. One is singing the main part and other is making a short response. Mm-hmm. And it is always talking about sad things. For instance, a bachelor who cannot find a woman, things like that. And therefore, and he is alone. And people go, you know, they call it, it is my bicycle. Because when they go on the road, they are playing the mbira and singing on it. It's like a motor.
So do I play for myself when I'm thinking? Yeah. Or does someone play for the chief while he's thinking? Or
no.
For oneself.
I'm playing for myself when I'm sad, and it makes me a little bit feel better. And I tell my stories and my difficulties to live to people who are around, and people who want to listen, they stop and they sit down.
Wow. We have so many callers who want to join our conversation. We've been keeping them waiting, but the music is too delicious not to listen to. Let's go to Music City, USA, Nashville. Acme is calling. Acme, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah. I just had a question for the expert. My friend got one of these gamelan CDs probably about 3 years ago, and the liner notes on the inside of the CD was talking about the island that it came from, the specific island, hadn't been really, hadn't been disturbed really by, like, Western culture.
Yes.
And a guy came down there and recorded them and said that this music had been, like, it was music, like, solely from a human's brain. There was, like, no influence, and I just wondered if the experts had, like, a comment on that.
Michael, what about Balinese? I assume we mean thank you, Acme. Balinese, it has to be. It wasn't recorded clearly, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So it did grow up in that kind of closed environment.
The Balinese music is quite pure. In other words, but it's different kind of purity now than it used to be. And before maybe 30, 40 years ago, they really, truly had not had much outside influence.
So they didn't have CD players or even cassette tapes. This was all their own local production.
Right. Now they have plenty of CD players, and they have television, and they have recording studios and electric guitars. And so now they are striving consciously to preserve the music.
Does that make you and Simha curators now of dying traditions?
Not in my case.
What about in Central Africa?
No, it's not dying, but it is regressing. Nothing to do, it is regressing.
Would they have Madonna instead, or, I don't know, Western music that comes in, or music from the coasts, more popular African music?
Popular African music is coming through the radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Yeah.
That's what they listen when they have money to have radio, which is not always the case. And it's quite important to record as many as possible music just to have it because later they will come and say, what happened to our music? Where is our music? And their music should be preserved somewhere so they can find it again and make it revival.
I'm glad you recorded it. Bill in Concord, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Yes. Good day, gentlemen.
Hi.
I am touched by hearing the Javanese gamelan. I'm a composer. And I studied with a man named Stanley Hollingsworth as an undergraduate, who was a great devotee of Balinese gamelan. Mm-hmm. Made many trips there, I think some with his dear friend Lee Hoiby, and took his own recordings of much of this. And Stanley's teaching method was very much, he had studied with Scolero and Mio, and was very focused on counterpoints. And when he became interested in gamelan, he caused all of us to listen and analyze this music in order to improve our sense of polyphony and of polyrhythm.
Has it worked for you, Bill? Do you find yourself importing some of that wonderful polyrhythm?
Absolutely. And although I have a very lyrical style, yes, absolutely, it comes into my composition all the time. And in fact, what it did for me is really opened my eyes in the Western musical language to really being able to exploit counterpoint and serial techniques and canon and all sorts of things with a tremendous ease.
Bill, our time is short before the break. I want to get Michael Tenger's response. Michael, you've done composing yourself. Does it integrate?
Well, yes, of course it does. And Bill and I are among many, many composers. But take it outside the realm of music, and just for the listener in general, to think that when you have a deep, a serious encounter with another culture or another way of looking at the world, you can't be the same anymore.
We're talking about the deep role and architecture of traditional music of the world, from Bali to Africa. You can join the conversation, 800-423-8255. Hear from the Banda Linda in Africa, Njadre Balendro. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the deep role and architecture of traditional, often pre-modern music of the world, from Bali to Africa, with a couple of great ethnomusicologists. Simha Arom, French Israeli ethnomusicologist, joins us today. He took his microphones years ago into Central Africa and pygmy tribes there with quite remarkable music. Behind us right now, music from Bali, Michael Tenzer is with us from the University of British Columbia, great specialist in gamelan and Balinese music. They both joined me by great good fortune in the studio today. You can join the conversation this hour. What do you think? Do you have to be a Central African, an Aka pygmy, a child of Bali, to hear this music's magic, its message? And how do you see the role of the ethnomusicologist? What do they bring us that you can't download from iTunes? What's the insight you want from them? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Michael, what was that we just heard? This was gamelan with vocals.
Actually, it's a recording of a theatrical performance. It's music that goes back probably 600 years. Originally was performed in the royal courts and is dramatizing the stories of ancient kings and so forth. And you heard a woman singing there, like the attendant to the queen, and singing in this very swoopy, stylized voice like that.
Oh, absolutely beautiful. And 600 years old, that definitely predates globalization of music. I want to talk a little bit about how some of these influences, Balinese and African, have been brought into music that many of us may know. If we go back to something we heard very early on from Simha Arom's recording, this is the singer with a one-note whistle and singing along. Let's listen again. Okay, brace yourself for a little culture swing. Here from her 1994 album Bedtime Stories is Madonna's with her Sanctuary. You are my sanctuary. Simha Arom, is that your pygmy music in the background there? How did that get
in
there?
Exactly. I didn't know it. I ignored it totally. And the friends of mine said, "Do you know Madonna used one of your pieces in her?" Well,
do you welcome that? Does it sound like exploitation to you, or are you happy for it to be spread into even pop music?
I don't see any benefit to anyone in this. I think the pygmy music by its own is strong enough to be kept like it is, and they don't need the help of Madonna to be known.
But I'm guessing that this album sold, who knows, even millions of copies. Yeah. So buried behind her vocals and her videos and everything else, people do get a taste of what you found in Central Africa.
Yes, it's not the only. It happens many times. We cannot do anything against
it. The question might be, what is going back to the pygmies?
Oh, well, that's true. Residuals there, somehow we doubt it. Here's another example of the influence going on. This is from Herbie Hancock, older. This is from the 1973 album Headhunters. This is a famous Watermelon Man. Simha Arom, here we are again. How do you account for this? Do you know how this showed up in Herbie Hancock's work? Do you know the origin of it?
I didn't know it, and it was in 75 or 76, I was a guest at Bloomington University, and at a party, one of my colleagues said, did you any heard this record, a white record? And he put it on the CD player, and I was quite surprised, and I'm still surprised when I heard this. Yeah.
It's pretty amazing, and pretty directly from the heart of Central Africa there. Let me get to take a call here from Watertown, Massachusetts, and Beverly. Beverly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I called because there was a point made earlier in the program about the two little girls from The Pygmy.
Yes, with their beautiful duet, yes.
Yes, and how spontaneous it was, because the second child came out and then just started singing. And then there was a discussion about whether children do this in different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think of an experience I had when I was in kindergarten. I'm African American, mm-hmm. and all the kids in my class were black except for one.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing a quiet activity, probably coloring at our little table.
Right.
And someone started singing Hambone, which is a black folk song.
Yeah.
I, of course, didn't even know that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then, most of us probably joined in, and we were singing Hambone together while we were coloring. And one of the first thoughts I had about it, I don't know when that came to me, I've thought about it many times since,
mm-hmm.
was that it was the only activity that we had ever done in class that our teacher had not directed us to do.
And it felt like it had come spontaneously. Can you hum a little Hambone for us, Beverly?
Sure.
Yeah.
Hambone, Hambone, where you been? Been around the world, gonna go again. Hambone. Hambone, Hambone, have you heard?
It's great. It's terrific. So here, now, I know from a lovely dinner last night over a glass of wine with Simha that he won't go for this word spontaneous when it comes to his recording, because it came out of a culture. Now, you might sing spontaneously. I'm sure you did, Beverly, but in a way, as you're saying yourself, it comes from there's a tradition behind it at the same time. But is this, picture this, Simha, here's Beverly with her, African-American classmates in kindergarten, 6 years old maybe, beginning to sing like this. Is this somehow related to your beautiful duet of girls singing in Central Africa or not?
I wouldn't say that, because what you said, there's a culture of hundreds of years behind this. They don't just, it's not a repertoire for children,
mm-hmm.
it is a repertoire of the adult people, and they sing it as a spontaneous expression. They make on these variations, they have some canvas to do it, and it such a song will never be as other song will never be performed twice the same way. There are always variations on it, and they are always changing it.
Mm-hmm. You can hear, though, Michael, everybody wants to sort of be part of one world. We're told about globe, the family of man, that we...
Well, I understand what Simha is saying. I think that the song Hambone, this is not something that I know particularly, mm-hmm. but there is some continuity in African-American traditions that goes back a long time and that may even go back as far as the mother continent.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not, I don't want to make any claims, but it's not impossible that spontaneous eruption of Hambone could be ultimately traced to that kind of a traditional culture.
Beverly, thank you so much for your call. Now, in another vein, here's a comment on Facebook from Mark. And I'm not sure which cut he's thinking of, but maybe several. He says, I find this music atonal and very hard to listen to. He says, do you think there is a genetic link as to why they might like that type or tone of music as opposed to a more Western type of music? What do you say, Michael?
No, I don't think there's any genetic link. Cultures are very powerful forces. Mm-hmm. We get used to certain things being certain ways. The music that you grow up with becomes deeply part of who you are and your identity, and takes the desire to learn and communicate with others, and especially because so in order to adjust mm-hmm. to the sounds of another culture's music, and especially because music is so important to all of us.
Well, so we're programmed. I mean, even some people play Mozart.
We
play
it.
Mozart in utero.
Yeah.
You're hearing a certain scale and a certain rhythm.
Right, right.
From very early.
It just shows you how important music is to us, though. And
it's kind of basic software.
And also, it's just a basic human activity that we relate to so much, and we're so proud of our own musical. Everybody's so proud of the music that they love. So it takes time to adjust to others.
Let's hear. I mean, Mark on Facebook, I don't know if you'll like this or not, but this is really kicking. Here's a kind of a virtuoso, more contemporary gamelan, 25-person ensemble, start and stop, super high-speed energy. This is this is what you've written about so much, Michael, the gamelan Gong Kabyar.
My music.
Let's hear. There they are really kicking it in Gamelan Gong Kabyar. Faith in Newton, Massachusetts. Faith, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've had the good fortune to visit Bali 4 different times over the past 20 years.
Wow.
And the music is just so mesmerizing. And my observation has been that the musicians, as they're playing, are in a very contemplative place. The music is quite lively, but they're very serene. And I've also observed,
it's a wonderful observation.
Yeah, the musicians having their children sit on their lap and sort of learn the music in a very sort of visceral way. It's an amazing culture, and I'm really happy to hear your guests speaking about it today.
Faith, thanks for reporting that. And Michael, what about that serenity up against that hyper speed and complexity?
The achievement of that music we just heard is that the musicians, 25 of them, can execute something of such virtuosity and such that requires such in close human cooperation. And the only way to do that is to be in a state of complete relaxation, because the music may sound to the listener like it's tense or agitated. Mm-hmm. But if you are tense or agitated, you cannot make that music.
No, you just couldn't keep up with it.
You have to be in a very calm space in your mind.
Well, that's fantastic. Charlie in Hilton Head, South Carolina. Charlie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just have to say right off, this is a wonderful program, so evocative for me, because my wife and I had the privilege of visiting Bali 20 years ago, and this music still resonates in my head.
Yes.
One thing that I found, though, very interesting was the contrast between Balinese gamelan and Javanese gamelan. I found the Javanese gamelan hard to listen to, but not the Balinese. It was wonderful, and especially when mixed with dance or with in a puppet show or some other thing. It's just it was wonderful, and it still resonates in my head. I hear it all the time in my head.
Oh, Charlie, thanks for calling. I mean, through Michael Tenzer's kind of inspiration, I had the good fortune to be in some of his Balinese turf too, and it is absolutely wonderful. But what about it, Michael? Why might Balinese sink in more easily than Javanese?
I think the simple reason is that Balinese music is constructed more like Western music. It's got a very precise kind of composition, and even if you're new to it, you can hear where things start and stop. Whereas Javanese music comes from a very different, much more mystical tradition in which it's a much more inner kind of music, and you really need to spend a little more time with it before you understand how it makes sense.
Let's soar back to Africa, and here's a music from a dance for a rite of passage from the Banda Linda in Africa. Banda Linda of Central Africa. Let's go to Kurt in Stonington, Connecticut. Kurt, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
This music is incredible. Before, you were talking about binaural beats and trance.
Yes.
A number of years ago, I worked with that a little bit, and it's like when you tune a guitar and it's slightly off, you'll get the overtones as either an alpha or a beta, or what's called entrains. your brain waves.
Okay.
And I can hear that in the gamelan music. It's what happens is when you get two notes that are very close, it creates a third note, and that note can entrain your brain waves into a trance. So in Buddhist, like Tibetan chants, they do that. They entrain, and so what I heard was the earlier gamelan was sort of an alpha, and you were talking about images.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is gamma, which is up at 32 cycles per second, which is much more exciting. But you have to, exactly what the listener said, you have to be relaxed and tune in to the music further than the normal beats that we usually have.
Kurt, I love it. We were talking about that just before the show, and I appreciate that. Let me get one more, if I may. Burlington, Vermont. Myra, you're on the air, Myra.
Hi. So many of your callers have touched upon what I was thinking. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say I love that you brought a program about ethnomusicology onto the air, and that for me it's all about the fact that we are just as diverse as humans. Our songs, like birds, whatever, and ethnomusicology just provides us this incredible opportunity to explore and understand each other. And if we are relaxed and let music, whether we're familiar or not, penetrate us, it's just an amazing thing.
Myra, you put it beautifully, and I thank you for your call. Somehow a realm, our time is short, but it's so true. This is your life's work. There's an insight into our fellow human beings that comes through grappling with this music, that there's no better way to understand something about someone who may come from another culture.
No, well, I think it's exactly what I would say, that the richness of humanity, one of its expression is in the music, and therefore it's so important, interesting, and we can learn from it and enrich ourselves from the contact and the being in contact with other cultures and with the music of other cultures. And music is something very special because it's not like books, not like architecture, not like images, because it's vanishing away if you don't keep it immediately.
Mm. You can find excerpts from the music you've heard today at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Tenzer, maybe this will make its way onto the iPods of the world and have a new life.
Well, I think this music is available for people who want to listen to it, but I urge people to explore something unfamiliar and learn something new through it.
You are both so generous to be with us. Thanks for your recordings from the field, the work of a lifetime, and for the great gamelan from Bali, Simha Arom and Michael Tenzer. Thank you very, very much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. We've got with gamelan Bala Ganjur. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.